Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Former Vice President Al Gore has been making good use of his time since leaving office and in spite of winning the popular vote but losing the presidency to George W. Bush in 2000. Much of Gore's time since has been spent warning about and working on climate change issues. His documentary Inconvenient Truth changed the discussion on global warming. It's more of the same in his new book, The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. Mr. Gore was in St. Louis this past weekend, where he spoke to a sellout crowd of 800 at the St. Louis County Library headquarters. It's part of the Westfall Authors series there. It was my honor to introduce him and interview him as part of the 90-minute program that included written questions from the audience. This is an abridged version of the former vice president's remarks. He began by telling the audience of the need for such a book as his.
About 8 years ago, I was speaking at a conference in Europe, and somebody asked me, what are the drivers of global change? And I confidently gave what I thought was an adequate answer, and in the moment, I thought it was more than adequate. But on the plane flight back to the U.S., the question kind of kept nagging at me a little bit, and I took out my computer and started making an outline, and I just wasn't satisfied with it, and I kept on working and moving things around. And when I got back home, I really became kind of obsessed with it. It turned out to have some practical value in the real world. I had founded an investment management firm called Generation Investment Management with my partner David Blood. Incidentally, I wanted to name the firm Blood and Gore, but I hope you won't think less of me when I tell you that I really did want to name it that, but probably wisely the other partners wouldn't go along with it. But we started using this outline as one of the main inputs in our investment process, and it had some real value, and we manage a little over $8 billion, and we've used it to good effect. I'm going to knock on wood, because anybody in the investment business knows that the future has its own dynamic, and what's happened over the last 9 or 10 years, you've got to keep at it. But in any case, I kept on working on this project, and 2 years ago, I decided to turn it into a book, and I cleared all the furniture out of my living room in Nashville and put up giant whiteboards and directed research that compiled 15,000 pages, and this is more than you want to know about the process. All I'm trying to get across to you is there's a lot of work in this, and if it looks like a thick book, remember there are 150 pages of footnotes, so it's half as easy to get through as it looks like, and I recommend the footnotes. I worked hard on them, but in any case, I started off also by asking some of the deepest thinkers and best minds I could find in the various fields to come together. We met at Harvard and had a two-day scoping exercise. I asked one of them at the beginning of it, just kind of an emotional test, you know, how do you feel about the future? And one of them said, well, I feel fine. And that made me think of a story, because 35 years ago, when I was a young congressman representing 25 rural counties in Middle Tennessee, one Saturday I had had a full day of town hall meetings, and I was a little tired driving back to my farm in the evening, and I was listening to the Grand Ole Opry on the car radio. And back in those days, they had a comedian named Cousin Minnie Pearl. And a few of y'all remember her. She was a wonderful person, and her character was the one with the price tag still hanging from the straw hat and the calico dress. And anyway, she told a story about a farmer who was involved in an accident, and he suffered some harm, damages, and he sued the driver of the other vehicle and got to court, and the lawyer for the other driver put this farmer on the witness stand and cross-examined him. And he said, now, isn't it true that immediately after this accident, you said, I feel fine? And the farmer said, well, it's not that simple. You see, I was taking my cow to town in the back of my truck, and this feller came driving across the center of the highway, and the lawyer said, wait a minute, I object. We're in the middle of a trial here. We don't want to hear a long story. Just answer the question, yes or no. Did you or did you not say, immediately after the accident, I feel fine? And the farmer said, well, I was leading up to that. You see, I was taking my cow to town in the back of my truck, and this feller came driving across the center of the highway and ran right smack dab into my truck and knocked it over and threw me out, threw the cow out. I was on one side and the cow was on the other, and the highway patrolman came up and took one look at that cow and said, she is suffering. Pulled out his gun and shot her right between the eyes. He came around to my side of the truck and said, how do you feel? So I said, I feel fine. And I think there's something of that attitude in the way some of us think about the future. Compared to what? You know, well, actually, the future is unfolding more quickly now than it ever has in the past. And it may be that every previous generation has felt the same thing. But there's something qualitatively different in this day and age because the scientific and technological revolution has really been picking up speed. These computers get twice as powerful for the same money every 18 months. The genetic engineering advances are just mind-blowing. The globalization process is now connecting everything all over the world. The power shifts are changing around the world, and you see it every single day. And one of the most unusual things about our present time is that never in the past have so many revolutionary changes been unfolding at the same time, and it's kind of hard to get your arms around all of it. You can read stories and hear people on TV, and you get all absorbed in one of these things, and at the same time, all these other things are going on, and then something else will come up. You'll read about that. And so I wanted to get it all in one place and get a real sense of, hey, wait a minute. If our future is going to be shaped by all of these things together, how are they interrelating one with the other? And what's it going to mean for our families? What's it going to mean for our communities? And how fast are these changes going to take place? And are the changes all good? We know they're not all good, but is there something we can do to shape them? And are there choices we can make to pick more of the good and prevent some of the harm that might be unfolding there? And so that's really the purpose of this book. And I learned a lot in writing it, and I came to believe that it really does have value. I'm recommending it to you, but if you read it, I hope you'll read it with an open heart and mind to the point that you will consider personally being a positive agent for change. Because one of the underlying themes in this book, and I'll return to this at the end of my opening comments here, one of the underlying themes is we here in the United States of America do still have a special role to play. And that's not just false pride in thinking our country's the greatest in the world. It is the greatest in the world. And you go to any country, anywhere in the world, and they still believe in their hearts that the United States of America is the natural leader of the world. But you know what? A lot of them will ask questions. They'll say, what's going on? How come y'all have been making decisions that seem just unlike the United States of America? We've been kind of making some big mistakes, you know? And the rest of the world has begun to question whether or not they can afford to follow us, you know, just automatically the way they would often do in the past. But they still want to. They know that we've got the values and the principles and the Constitution and the traditions and the people to open up the brightest future possible. That's why so many people want to come here. That's why so many countries want to shape their governance rules in their economies according to principles that they've seen work so well here in the United States. But we as Americans have a big job to do. Listen, our democracy has been hacked. It's not working the way it should. You know what the word, you know, when a computer's hacked, somebody figures out how to take control of the operating system of your computer and make that computer do things that you don't necessarily want it to do. Well, that's happening in Washington, D.C. right now. It really is. And I'm not running for anything. This is not some, you know, political rhetoric. You know it's true. We just got past the fiscal cliff. And now 3 weeks from now, we got another cliff. I got cliff fatigue. I'm tired of government by crisis all the time. Why don't they just pass the budget and pass the appropriations and authorization bills and work together, and when they disagree, debate things and don't filibuster everything? Or if they're going to filibuster, at least go there like Mr. Smith and stand up and talk until they run out of breath. This business of phoning in a filibuster and stopping everything is just for the birds. Now, I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. But we also have problems in our economy, because capitalism is the greatest system ever devised for organizing economic activity. It unlocks a higher fraction of the human potential. It balances supply and demand, allocates resources, is more consistent with higher levels of freedom than any other system devised for organizing economics. And yet, we see these increasing disruptions, like the Great Recession, like the credit crisis, like the flash crash, like the subprime mortgages. What was that all about? Subprime mortgages? Well, I remember when I made my first mortgage years ago in Carthage, Tennessee. I went to Citizens Bank and I sat across the desk from Walter Glenn Birdwell Jr. And he asked me a long series of questions. And I had to answer in writing. And these questions were designed to build his confidence that I would be able to make the monthly payments on that mortgage. And then I had to sign something. What was it? Some of y'all will remember this. It was a down payment. That's what it was. Well, with the subprime mortgages, there weren't any down payments. And there weren't any questions. And 7.5 million of them were given to people who had no earthly way to pay them back. They were bound to default. So why did they do that? Well, they thought, okay, globalization. We're going to, you know, it's risky to give a mortgage to somebody who can't pay it back, but if you take lots of mortgages like that and lump them all together and attach them to some tricky, slippery insurance derivative instrument, and then sell that into the global marketplace, well, the risk is gone. That was the theory. But when it was tested, all of a sudden it collapsed, and it triggered a global run on the banks, and the credit flows stopped, and the Great Recession started, and we are still trying to achieve escape velocity to keep this recovery going and get fully out of the Great Recession. So my point is this. That was a bad decision was my point. Here's another bad decision. I don't want to start an argument here, and I don't want to risk a partisan comment, but we did invade a country that didn't attack us, and we had to stay there for 10 years, and we caused a lot of geopolitical harm. And I'm really not making a partisan point. I think most people agree with that at this time. We may have a dispute about whether the evidence was completely false and deceptive and all of that. I think it was, but you can have, if you disagree, then you're wrong. I'm just kidding. Sort of. But here really is the larger point that I'm making, and I'm deadly serious about this. People around the world began to think, we've been following the United States, but look at what they did geopolitically. Look at what they did economically. Look at what they did with their principles in torturing people, this, that, and the other. And all of a sudden, the rest of the world started thinking, Whoa. Maybe we ought to kind of find our own new path here. Who else are we going to follow? China? The European? Who? And I believe there is no alternative to the United States of America as leader for the world. And that's not, again, just false pride. It is a statement of fact. So this book is intended in part to lay out as clearly as I am capable of laying out what the big challenges are and really appeal to the American people. It's an appeal to people around the world, and it's selling in a lot of other countries, but it's mainly aimed at the people of our country to say a lot's at stake because the future our children and grandchildren are going to grow up in is going to unfold either with our participation and leadership or without. And if it unfolds without U.S. leadership and without the kind of values and principles and dedication to the public good that the United States of America has always stood for, then it won't be what it should be for our children and grandchildren and those who come after them.
You are listening to former Vice President Al Gore during his appearance before a sellout crowd at the St. Louis County Library last Saturday. More in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. This is St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. More now from former Vice President Al Gore talking about his book, The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change, at the St. Louis County Library last weekend. He talked about those 6 points with emphasis on his favorite subject, climate change.
You'd be surprised if one of the six drivers in a book written by me wasn't the climate crisis. And indeed it is. And it is one of the six, and it interacts with all of the others. So I'll just say a brief word. You all know from somebody mentioned, Don mentioned an inconvenient truth earlier. Thank you. So I said 85% of the energy from Earth Inc. is used by Earth Inc. is based on carbon-based fuels. The combustion of those fuels results in the spewing of global warming pollution every day, in the amount of 90 million tons into the atmosphere as if it is an open sewer. And the science has been warning us for a long time that it traps a lot of heat, and it does. You know, I was with a group earlier this week. I gave a eulogy for a dear friend of mine at Harvard University who used to talk about how they discovered the cause of cholera. It used to be one of the deadliest killers ever. In London, back in the 18th century, they took all the cases of cholera and plotted them on a map. And on top of that map, they put the sewer system. And they traced the cases, and they eventually traced it to a single pump. Now, in the early cities, they would often have a trench in the middle of the street where the human sewage would come down the street. And when the population grew and the cities got bigger, it came a point where people said, you know, maybe it's not a great idea. And so they stopped using the streets as open sewers. Well, they've connected the dots on what's causing these extreme weather events and what's causing global warming. It's the global warming pollution. In fact, the amount that we've put up there now is trapping enough extra heat around the world every single day to equal the energy contained in 400,000 Hiroshima atomic bombs going off every day. It's a big world, but that's a lot of energy. And that's what's drying out the soil and helped to put 61% of our country in drought last year and helped cause those massive fires in the West again. Melted off half of the North Polar ice cap last summer with the rest of it in jeopardy. That's what's evaporating all this water vapor off the oceans into the air. And the warmer air holds so much more water vapor that when the storm conditions trigger a downpour, you get these massive floods. And you get massive snowstorms. And we've always had floods and snowstorms, but they're bigger and they're more frequent. And the winds coming off the ocean are much stronger. Last year in our country, we had $110 billion in climate-related disaster damage. Never has anything been even close to that. Superstorm Sandy, devastating Manhattan and parts of New Jersey. You know, when I put out my movie, probably the single most common criticism was people say, oh, that's irresponsible and exaggerated for him to show ocean water going into the World Trade Center memorial site. How could he show something like that? Well, it happened. At the end of October last year, way ahead of schedule. How long are we going to wait? And how long are we going to be silent about it? The silence is deafening. It's almost like a family with an alcoholic father who flies into a rage every time alcohol is mentioned. And so the family learns never to mention the word or the problem, just to keep the peace. We went through a presidential election last year while all this was going on, hottest year in American history, with more presidential debates than we have ever had. And not one single journalist in one single debate asked a single candidate any question about the climate crisis. That is pathetic, and it's an affront to our democracy. Now, let me sum up because I've gone over. All six of these trends are very powerful, and they're unfolding whether we like them or not. Many of them bring great opportunities. In the case of the climate crisis, in many areas of the world, the price of solar electricity and wind electricity is now coming down so fast. Australia just announced 3 days ago wind electricity is cheaper than from coal or gas now. In many areas, that's now happening. 2010, global investment in solar and wind and renewables exceeded for the first time global investment in fossil fuels. There are millions of jobs to be created, and that's just not a political slogan. I'm not in politics. That is a fact. There are opportunities in all these trends. But we have to consciously participate in making choices so that we seize the opportunities and protect the future against some of these trends that could be extremely dangerous. And the world needs to do that because they're global in nature. And the world has to have leadership from the United States of America. And the United States of America has to reclaim the integrity of our democracy. And you, we, the people, are the ones who have to do that. And I hope that you will participate in doing so. Thank you very much. I look forward to your questions.
During his weekend appearance at St. Louis County Library, former Vice President Al Gore took questions from me and from the audience. He had talked earlier about the need for individuals to become more engaged to effect change. I wondered how to get past the cynicism and frustration many feel about government and gridlock.
Yeah, there's a barrier of inertia, and cynicism and hopelessness and despair, those are heavy burdens to carry and big obstacles to break through. Here's one source of hope for me, Don. If you think about the way we communicate in our democracy from the beginning of the United States of America until now, I see it kind of like a play in three acts. Act one was dominated by the printing press, and the printing press served us well. It had certain characteristics. Individuals could easily jump in the conversation and learn what everybody else was saying and contribute their own views and If somebody liked what you said, then they'd kind of cluster around it. Thomas Paine, January of 1776, published Common Sense. It helped to ignite the revolution. The founders wouldn't even ratify the Constitution until they went back and had the amendment to guarantee the freedom of the printing press. And it was an equalizer. And it made it possible for ideas and principles and goals and dreams to outweigh money and power. And through most of human history, the people with the money and the power and the weapons have called the tune. But in our country, what made us special is we set up this system where ideas, where the mass of people would debate and agree that one idea was better than another, they could push it with their representatives and senators. And then the wealth and power, they'd have to sometimes take a back seat. It was never perfect, but it worked pretty dang well. Act Two, television. Television became more important than newspapers in 1962. That's when the lines crossed. And it's so important now that 80% of the money spent by both political parties goes to these 30-second TV ads. And the television's different. As I said, you can talk back to the TV, but it doesn't hear you. And the people who have access have to have a lot of money. Thomas Paine in today's Philadelphia could walk out his front door, and instead of finding 10 print shops nearby, he walks down to the nearest TV station and says, I've got Common Sense on a television program. I'm ready to go. When do I go on? Well, he's not going on unless he pays $10 million or something for the privilege. Now, Act Three. Act Three is the Internet. And the Internet is still in its early days, but it's growing by leaps and bounds. Young people particularly are using it very effectively. I think it's one of the reasons why young people in this generation are way more involved in their communities and doing volunteer work and public interest stuff in their communities than any previous generation. And they're beginning to figure out how to use it in regional, state, national politics. And television's still dominant, as I said, but already you see individual bloggers begin to have an impact on debates, and I think the day is fast coming when we will be able to use it. So I encourage people to get involved on the Internet and form your groups and find people who agree with your reform initiatives and you know, early to bed, early to rise, work like hell, and organize.
So Thomas Paine... Thomas Paine would have to learn how to use Twitter, certainly, to get to get going.
I bet he could do it.
I bet he could. Speaking of television, then I'll move on to the questions from the audience. You've taken some hits recently because of the sale of Current TV to Al Jazeera. Every interview that I've seen recently, you've done a lot of them on television. This is where they've jumped you every time.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're calling you a hypocrite for having sold to Al Jazeera.
Yeah.
Were you prepared for this? Did you think this was going to happen?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I knew I would face questions. I knew I'd probably get a question even in the St. Louis County Library. And
I hope he didn't disappoint you.
No, and you should. And I knew there would be criticism. But I knew after doing my diligence and investigation that it was the right thing to do in spite of that. As a businessman, I certainly knew it was the right thing to do for my shareholders. But more importantly, I had a duty as a businessman to do business in a way that makes the country better, that makes the general situation better. And after investigating it, there was absolutely no question in my mind that this has been established long since as a very highly respected news gathering network that is basing its whole future on building and maintaining a reputation for integrity and objectivity. Al Jazeera English has been winning awards everywhere it's on. There are very few people in the U.S. that have it now, but people that do love it. And Al Jazeera America is going to be better still. In Israel, one of the big systems, there's on two of the main Israeli cable systems, and one of them kicked off CNN and replaced it with Al Jazeera. And one reason is, you know, I don't want to knock CNN. I watch them from time to time.
You did knock Fox the other day pretty well.
Yes. And in England last year, it was named the news network of the year. And by the way, on climate coverage, I mentioned the pitiful performance of our networks last year. Al Jazeera has high quality, way more extensive coverage of the climate crisis than any other network in the world. Yes, it's owned by Qatar. And yes, Qatar is based on gas and oil. But, you know, they gave him a loan a long time ago. They give him some support. But they're focused on establishing and maintaining that reputation for true journalistic excellence. And by the way, so it was the right thing to do, but you will not have to take my word for it. Within 2 months, you'll be able to see for yourself.
All right. Well, that's the Al Jazeera question of the night then. Let's, let's move on to questions from the audience.
Well, at least there weren't 12 of them.
We don't have too much time, unfortunately. Okay. How different do you think this country would be today if you had been president instead of George Bush? Plus, I'm going to combine a second question in the same vein. This person writes that still depressed that you did not win the presidency. That being said, please share something good that came of you not taking office so I can finally move on.
Well, I do encourage people to move on. I'm very grateful for the feelings that are so palpably evident in those questions, and I'm grateful. And, you know, I certainly have moved on. I do think that things would have been very different. But, you know, sometimes people ask me, how'd you deal with that? Hey, gosh, that must have been a hard hit. I'll tell you honestly, Don, there are so many people in this audience who in their personal lives have been through so much worse. And it's useful for all of us to remember that the people we encounter in our daily lives, quite a few of them, a lot that we don't even know about, are carrying incredibly heavy burdens and have gone through a lot, and they deal with it, and they move on, if they can, and most do. Well, what choice do you have? You try to make lemonade, and you try to keep moving forward. And I'm very grateful to have found other ways to be able to serve and to make a difference. And now, the opposite question I sometimes get is from somebody who says, do you think you've been able to make a bigger difference than if you'd been elected? Well, I don't hold to that at all, because I'm under no illusion that there's any position with anywhere nearly as much potential to bring about positive change than the position of president. But I ran for president twice, didn't work out. I can tell you the reasons why, but we don't need to go into that. But you move on. And so life has been enjoyable, and I'm trying to serve in a positive way. Thank you.
Back with more from former Vice President Al Gore in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Back with our conversation with former Vice President Al Gore, we took a question from the audience. The audience member asked, how should elementary schools be targeted for the future?
Well, there are probably some teachers here. Any one of them would be able to answer this question a lot better than I can. And so I don't want to pose as an expert, but I will give you my thoughts about it. Anybody here ever heard of something called the Khan Academy? For those of you who haven't, And if any teachers haven't, I particularly recommend it to you. Anybody with a young child in elementary, secondary school. K-A-H-N. You Google K-A-H-N, it's the first thing that pops up. It is an almost magical way to teach children the subjects that are covered there. It's a flip mechanism. Here's what they mean by the word flip. Today, kids go into the classroom and they get the instruction or the lecture or the presentation, and then they go home and do the homework. What they do at the Khan Academy is they flip that around. You get the lecture at home on the internet, and the kid can stop it and go back and go over it, stop it again, learn at his or her own speed, then take a little online quiz to make sure that they get everything completely down before they go to the next level. And they get all that at home. Then they go to the classroom, and in the classroom they'll do the homework type things, things they're having trouble with. And the teacher and their fellow students can help them sort through things that they haven't been able to get on their own. And I don't want to make too much of this particular model, but the larger point is that these kids now spend so much time on computer games and on the digital devices and all the whiz-bang stuff that's bright and flashy and everything, and you go down and look at a blackboard, it's almost an unfair burden to put on these teachers because these kids become accustomed to something that it's really hard to replicate in the classroom. And the global mind, as I described it, has such vast potential for education. The trick is, I think, and again, I don't know how to do it, really, but I've got some general ideas. I think the trick is to empower teachers in schools to make much more productive and creative use of these new tools. Now, just briefly, if I may, going up to the university level, there are these things called massively online universities. There's one called Coursera. Now, I'm an investor in Coursera, so I want to give you notice on that so you'll know. Khan Academy is a nonprofit, and Sal Khan, who runs it, is a close friend of mine, and I work with him when I can. But Coursera, they have 128 million students around the world now. And they have the top lecturers in the top colleges, and the courses are for free. And students from all over the world are taking these top-level courses, and of course a lot of them drop out. But they'll have students from India and China and Indonesia getting A-pluses on everything in villages there. Wow, that's amazing. Now, what are the consequences for U.S. competitiveness? That's another question. But the universal availability of knowledge, whether we're in elementary school, secondary school, or college, or post-grad, it's being revolutionized by the internet, and we need to find better ways to quickly take advantage of it.
Another question here. If environmental sustainability isn't a high priority of American business, how can we really get there in the days of Citizens United?
Well, it's a good question. I have actually been somewhat encouraged by the fact that many U.S. businesses are ahead of the politicians on this. And one reason is that they've discovered, some to their surprise, that when they set out to burnish their brand image and give the impression to their customers that they're committed to the environment, and they say they've got to actually do something to follow through on that, when they do, they find that, lo and behold, it usually doesn't cost them money, it saves them money. And that word is spreading out there now. Say you're a manufacturer. You buy raw materials and you turn it into products and pollution. If you cut down on the pollution, you're cutting down on your need for raw materials and maximizing your product. And, it's almost literally that simple. You take an example like News Corp. I'm not a big fan of News Corp. You know, they're the ones that have Fox News.
Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah, yeah. And they've been absolutely atrocious in trying to, you know, spread this propaganda about, you know, global warming isn't real. But 6-7 years ago, they invited me to come to their annual meeting at a time when they were toying with the idea of being different on that issue. And I challenged them to make a commitment to being carbon neutral. And they took up the challenge. And in spite of the fact that they put all this propaganda out there, today News Corp is carbon neutral. Now, why is that? It's not because they are true believers. It's because they have found out it is a better way of doing business. And this is beginning to happen in businesses around the world. There's a big movement toward sustainable capitalism, sustainable corporate planning, and it just makes good business sense.
This is a pretty good segue out of that question and answer. Mr. Gore, how do you suppose we implement climate control policies without contributing to the federal deficit, especially in these difficult economic times?
Well, don't you think if we started importing less oil, we'd be better off? I do. Also, if we stop subsidizing oil and coal, that would be one way to cut the deficit. You know, they talk about solar and wind getting subsidies. Lord knows that the subsidies to the oil companies and the coal companies are way bigger. On a global basis, there is annually $500 billion paid in subsidies to the fossil fuel companies. In fact, I mentioned those 90 million tons of CO2 going up there every day. We are subsidizing that at the rate of about $110 per ton. It's insane. And so we could cut the deficit by eliminating these subsidies for the fossil fuel companies, and we'd reduce the deficit, and then we'd make these solar and wind companies more competitive, and they're job rich. The wind industry now already has more jobs than the coal industry. And in California, for example, they've got these businesses now. They'll go out and they'll say they've got some small subsidies for solar, and they'll come to you as a business owner or a homeowner with the following proposition. They'll say, we will put solar panels all over your roof, and the next day your electricity bill will go down 20%. Okay, how much will it cost you? Oh, we'll do it for free. That's a pretty good proposition. And people are snapping up that proposition. And all it takes is a little bit of subsidy. You wouldn't even need that, maybe, if you got rid of the subsidy for coal and oil.
There seem to be some concerns, though, that we're going to have to rely on buying some of this technology from China and Denmark and countries like that who are doing so much more quickly.
Well, it's because they have subsidized the development of solar and wind. And China is doing way more on solar and wind than we are. Same on smart fast trains and smart grids. And they've marked it as a key opportunity for the 21st century. That's what we ought to do. We invented these technologies. We ought to be creating the jobs here.
You know, I've heard people say that this is going to be the century of the Chinese. Do you buy that?
I'm not sure it is, and I write a lot about that in this book. They certainly have the momentum, and they've had the sharpest drop in poverty and the fastest economic rise of any country in history. Within 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, they'll surpass us as the largest economy. But here's why I'm uncertain, Don. Over time, with the changing nature of the economy, any nation that does not have a free flow of information, where people who notice problems are not able to give voice to the problems, when people who see the need to do something differently aren't able to have free speech if it irritates somebody who's in power, over time, that just kind of jams things up. And they have not yet found it possible to allow free speech. So that's a big problem for them. Secondly, they've got a huge amount of corruption. And corruption, you know, every country maybe has a little bit of corruption, but it's kind of like inflation. If you get the hyper variety, you're in trouble. And they're in trouble on that. You will hear the word princeling in China. You know what a princeling is? A princeling is the next generation of one of the people who was in power, Mao and Deng Xiaoping and so forth. And if you go to do business over there, a lot of people come back and say this, the best way to be a success is to find one of those princelings and hook up with him. And then they'll fix the system so it works for you. Well, I guess a lot of countries like that, but over time, again, that's going to spell trouble. You take their windmills, for example. as many as 60% of their windmills are not even connected to the power grid. The blades move, they're not producing any electricity. Why is that? Because they've got the subsidies that are paid out when the windmill is built, but the system is not rational, and so the incentive is to just build it, whether or not it's producing any electricity. A lot of visitors to China will come back and say, I saw all these new apartment buildings and office buildings, and at night there were no lights in any of them. And maybe that's an exaggeration, but I've seen it for myself. Not much of an exaggeration. In some sections of some of their big cities, they have an incentive to keep on building all these buildings, and yet they don't have the tenants for them. And I think there's something like 36 million vacant apartments in China right now, but they're still building. Now, that's their business, but it's evidence that their underlying set of incentives is a little skewed. And it's an open question in my mind whether or not that's going to catch up with them and eventually lead to some trouble that will cause a slowdown in their growth.
And I think they're building 300 coal plants right now, aren't they, in the midst of all of this others?
Well, the figures I've seen are they open a new coal plant about every 9 days. They are simultaneously the biggest producer of coal and the biggest importer of coal. And by the way, I have partners in China, Kleiner Perkins China, and I was with them 2 weeks ago at an offsite, and they had just come from Beijing, and they said over the last few weeks the admissions to the hospitals there for respiratory problems had quintupled, multiplied by five. The government reports the air pollution in ways that are not really accurate. So the U.S. Embassy over there, I'm not sure who came up with this, but it's a great thing. They went out and got one of these little consumer model air monitors that gives an accurate reading, put it on the roof, and then used Twitter to put it out. And the government tried to stop that, and the people said, no, we want that. And they went out and got those little monitors, and now they're all over. And by the way, there's an app for that.
There's an app for everything.
You can go, if you're interested, anybody going to China, I'll just show you real fast here. If you go to the app store and ask for Chinese air quality, there it is. In Shanghai today, it's 210, very unhealthy. And Chinese people are upset about this, and they should be.
Maybe you can use your contacts in China to have them agree to establish a cargo hub here in St. Louis, which we've been talking about for quite a while, and something that the region would like to see happen. But
well, I I'll talk to Robin Carnahan.
I'm suspecting she would like to see that happen here too, but I don't want to speak for her, certainly. As we wind down, Mr. Gore, and we're talking about St. Louis, this question is, what do you see as the greatest challenge facing the St. Louis region?
Well, St. Louis is such a great city. I say it not to flatter you. You know it's the case. St. Louis is one of those cities like Philadelphia, Chicago. People move here and they live here a little while, and then they tell their neighbors from where they came, you won't believe what a great city this is. And people come visit, and they say, wow, there's so much stuff here. I didn't realize it was here. But the challenges include some of the same challenges that all of the older established cities have had, the hollowing out of manufacturing and the changes in the economy, some of which I talked about. I think that many of these trends I've described as bringing opportunities are ones that could really be of benefit to St. Louis. I describe a new technology, just to pick one example in the book, called 3D printing, which is sometimes referred to as additive manufacturing. It is now making it possible to insource, to bring manufacturing jobs that went overseas back into the U.S. Now, they don't bring as many jobs back with them, but they form a core for other economic prosperity that can build up around them. And so I think that extensive use of the internet, an aggressive policy to expand access to broader bandwidth to help bring these new models into your schools with the teachers driving the change, and to connect your businesses more, and to do what Jerry Schlichter is doing, and that is to have seed grants for entrepreneurs to build new startups.
That's
here.
The Arch grants you were mentioning earlier.
Yeah, the Arch grants. And there are many other examples. But I think that there is a dispersal of opportunity now. And cities that were based on a mass production era with railroads and highways bringing the raw materials and then taking the products back out, that model has been under stress for quite some time. But cities are places where people want to live. And cities that maximize the attractions of culture and the urban amenities and concentrate on community policing and cleaning up the environment, maximizing your riverfront, doing all the things that enhance art and culture. You know, there's one of the massive trends in the world is urbanization, and it's true in this country. And people are still coming to cities that attract them, and St. Louis is one of those. You get that critical mass and then empower them with these new opportunities, particularly this startup type thing, then I think the future can look very bright.
That was former Vice President Al Gore at the St. Louis County Library last Saturday. Our thanks to the County Library for their assistance in producing this program. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk about a Dance St. Louis and University of Missouri St. Louis collaboration on a ballet version of Carmina Burana, featuring the Nashville Ballet and four local music ensembles, and with quilt designer Susan Marth about the Abraham Lincoln tribute quilt she designed. Also, Aaron Williams talks with British conceptual artist Jeremy Deller about his retrospective exhibition at the Contemporary. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Terrence Blanchard about issues raised in Champion, his new opera based on the life of a gay boxer. We'll also meet the producer of a C-SPAN series examining the lives of White House First Ladies. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh.